All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 33 of the SLS Cast. Here's something for you. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Larry Bird both had number 33 on their jerseys. I'm Matt.
And I am Tim.
How's that for some knowledge dropped on you, son?
It's a very sportsy knowledge. It's weird. It's like the first few seconds of this show, it's very kind of like knowledgeable, and you seem like you're going to get like a quality program. Until people go through and look at our catalog of episode titles, and you realize how raunchy our titles can be.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think it matters a whit, because they see the title before they try to listen to the show.
So if they're going
as far to listen to pass the title to listen to the show,
right.
I figure anything they get on them knowledge-wise is just a bonus.
Crimson Pink, some quality
yes.
stuff.
That's right. Pacific Rim Jobs, you know.
All the above.
These are the stuff of legend, sir.
The stuff of legend. That should be like a little tagline. The SLS Cast with Matt and Tim. The stuff of legends. Or stuffed with legend.
Wow. All right. So how you been doing there, Tim?
I've been doing well. I've been doing a little bit of online shopping as of late. Bought myself a nice little tower, a little oscillating fan, which is kind of nice. And I decided to go in and buy myself one of those, you know, those like massagers, those back massagers. You can get the electric ones that have like two little prongs on it. Do you know what I'm talking about, or do you own one?
I don't know. Whenever I hear one of those large back massagers, I just think that's woman code for massive vibrator.
Well, in speaking of massive vibrator, whenever I think of buying like these little gadgets for your body, like a neck warmer or a neck bracelet that gently smooths the tensed neck, I think of Brookstone, the same Brookstone that is in all of our malls around the globe, or at least in the U.S. I don't know if Bangkok.
I always thought Brookstone was really just a Sharper Image knockoff.
Well, I thought Sharper Image was the Brookstone knockoff. Who came first?
I have no idea.
Brookstone or
I do
Sharper
know
Image.
That for me, that's like the guy version of window shopping. I would always go in there and be like, wow, this stuff
sit
is
down.
Totally cool, and then never buy anything.
Well, I went online the other day and went to Brookstone.com to look up a, you know, just a little back massager. So I'm going through and I'm like, okay, well, I wasn't too sure what to call a like a handheld back massager. It wasn't coming up in like their keyword item search or whatever. So I went to like their categories, and one of them said personal massager. So I thought, huh, I could have sworn a personal massager meant something other than a massager strictly used for massaging your back and upper non-groinal region. Well, you know, I was looking at it, and then I was looking at their various models of massagers, and I found one that looked more like a turkey baster, and it said personal massager. So I was like, what the hell? This? How can you use this on your back? It looks like it's like a little roller thing that you... I guess you can maybe roll the cramping and the knots out of your back. Like, you know, you're like rolling dough or something. It's like, I don't know. Well, they didn't have a video, so I can really see what it was. And of course, on Brookstone.com, their description of it really wasn't alluding to anything intimate whatsoever. So I found this other one. And Matt, if you don't mind opening up that link that I left you.
Allow me to be surprised here. It is loading.
I found this, and I thought, you know what? I don't think this is a back massager. So to find out some more information about it, I saw something that is both emotionally scarring, or sexually scarring, and both hysterical. And Matt, if you don't mind pressing play on that video.
I shall press play on this video. I'm listening. Dun, dun, dun. Girl from Ipanema. Dun, dun. It's nice little acoustic stuff, yeah. For the woman who wants it all. Available in three vibrant colors. Which, based on the shape of this thing, you're never going to see those colors. They are definitely going to be embedded in body parts.
Exactly.
Sleek Scandinavian design.
And what's with that, like, hook thing?
It's because you have to...
It's like you either want to use it to, like, massage your neck or tickle your asshole. You really can't decide by the look of it, really.
Adaptable to the female form.
There you go. And do you see, like, the little finger point of it, like, kind of wiggling around? Like, you can just see it, like, wiggling.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is definitely a... yeah, there's just absolutely no way that this is not for anything other than masturbation.
Exactly.
Like, penetrating masturbation.
Yeah, and it's...
Oh, and then they turn it on! Two independent motors!
They do, and look at the little, like, the little anal one that's, like, wiggling about. Like, it's like a little finger, like, kind of, like, you know, waving at you.
Pleasure object INA. Oh, my God. Yeah. That is hilarious.
And you know what's also funny is that a lot of those personal massagers, they have a USB adapter to where you can charge it up on your computer. I would just love to see a woman, like, on the bus, having that thing charged in her computer, or having that, like, charging in her car while she's driving down the freeway. Or just, like, sitting there in traffic. Because I can just totally see her, like, picking and get up, you know, thinking it's her cell phone or, like, her iPod. I'm like, oh, no, well, that's the wrong thing. Soon, I bet they're either going to have personal massagers that are also an iPod. Or at least maybe an AM/FM tuner radio in it. If not, then they should have one. But I think, like, the creepiest and weirdest thing about this is that it's on brookstone.com. What if, like... a child goes on there to buy a gift for mom and dad, like a actual back massager or one of those fancy chairs you sit in and it, like, massages your ankles and your kinkles and your back fat and all that stuff. But instead they find one of these and think, like, oh, this is a massager for mom and dad. So they buy it and Christmas Day comes along and mom opens up her gift and it turns out, no, it's not a back massager. It is for the Netherlands. The little can opener looking device.
Wow. I can't believe that thing is on there. That's fucking hilarious.
There are more vibrators on there than there are actual back massagers. No joke.
That's just crazy. Crazy, sir. I can't begin to compete with that. You win. You win story time this week. I had a pretty average week in comparison. It was really busy. Lots of family stuff. But... Nothing compared to that. You win. Wow, you win. I mean, I know you didn't set out for this to be like a competition, but fuck, dude, you win. You got it. Yeah. Let's just go to the news. I'm sorry. We're going. It's the news. News. All right. I get to follow up the Lilo INA thing.
I think we found another sponsor for the show. Yes. The Lilo brought to you by Brookstone.
Oh my God, I guess so. All right. Well, speaking of other huge vibrating objects, we'll just go there. Guillermo del Toro confirms Pacific Rim 2. Yes, there we go. Because we get to combine rimming with sexual stimulation and vibrations and big machines. This is the only way I could follow it up. This comes from moviepilot.com, given to us from Von Garacani. Basically, Guillermo del Toro himself has come right out and said it. He confirmed that Warner Brothers has allowed he and his team to start writing a sequel, which is currently being worked on. He also said, quote, "I'll tell you a couple of things. We will have Gypsy 2.0 for sure. Second thing is you're going to see a merging of Kaiju and Jaeger. And that is quite special," end quote. Del Toro also said that a lot of the deleted scenes from the movie hinted at possible plot lines for a sequel. Pacific Rim ended with a huge showdown underwater and went through the portal into the Kaiju world. Don't worry, we're not going to tell you exactly how it ended. This is just
part of the grand finale.
You have to remember that, especially for people who haven't seen this movie, the synchronization of the human mind to these big machines proved to be too much for one person, so they came up with a synchronization method for two people called drifting. And part of the movie happens when we go, or when you get to see one of the human characters drifting with a kaiju brain. So we also have Del Toro telling us, quote, "The main idea that we're bouncing off of is the fact that Newt drifted with a kaiju brain, and all kaiju brains are connected. We say that they are like a hive mentality. So, you know, draw your own conclusions. We've drifted with a kaiju brain. Well, then start riffing on that and you'll get something," end quote. That definitely does leave it open for a sequel. There is a minor spoiler here, so mute it for about the next 5 seconds. He also said this, quote, "Just think about it for a second. We sent Gypsy to the other side, right? It exploded, but whatever remains stays there," end quote. And, you know, we'll wait here a couple extra seconds just in case you have a couple people who are like, "Oh, I really don't want this specific part spoiled." Okay. And then everybody dies at the end. Alright, so I really think that this is going to be a cool idea. After seeing what they did with the first one, and we covered it last week, I am genuinely interested to see what they could do for a sequel. I would definitely give this a shot. Also, in other sequel news, we also discussed Expendables 2 last week. And as I mentioned in the show, rather laughingly, because of how we went off on the tangent of the first Expendables. But then, now that Tim had been primed for what the Expendables was, he was able to better enjoy Expendables 2, though it's still not a great movie for him. And then I said, yep, well, we get to do it next year because they're going to have Expendables 3. Well, from coolnews.com, we have a screen cap of a tweet from Sylvester Stallone. And it's a very simple one. It says, "Mad Max versus Barney Ross." That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Mel Gibson is going to be the bad guy in Expendables 3. And given how much Hollywood has derided him and is basically, aside from Jodie Foster, trying to blackball him and keep him out of anything, I'm very curious to see how they handle this. What do you think, sir?
Yeah, no, I agree. He's actually also going to be the main villain in the next Machete movie as well, Machete Kills. So I'm excited for Mel Gibson. Did you see Get the Gringo? Because he did phenomenal in that movie. He brought back the whole 80s fun, all-out violent adventure movies that he is kind of known for.
Yes, I believe we talked about it. We didn't officially cover it on the show, I don't think. But I know that we both have seen it. And it is a fantastic movie. I was definitely very pleased to have seen that movie. I'm one of those diehard Mel Gibson fans. I mean, I realize he's got his problems and everything. I'm not trying to say that he's been the best husband, father, boyfriend, whatever, and that he should get Dad of the Year or something like that. He's got his demons. He's got his own personal problems. I don't personally think he's the evil Hitler racist that people make him out to be, but I guess I'm probably in the minority on that one. That's not to excuse any bad behavior, but I don't think he's as bad as people make him out to be. Next up, because my news is so overpowering this week that I only have 4 things and I've already gone through half of them. It's time to feel somewhat bad for Ryan Reynolds, I think. Part of it, I don't know that it's necessarily his specific fault or not, but he's definitely taking the blame for this. RIPD came out and sucked the ass that I knew it was going to suck. But along with that, Turbo also came out this weekend and apparently sucked some serious slug ass. And people are now asking, has anyone ever flopped so hard? This comes to us from Summer Movie Guide 2013, courtesy of Yahoo Movies. This article comes to us from Leslie Gornstein. The full tagline is, "Ryan Reynolds Turbo RIPD Double Whammy. Has anyone ever flopped so hard?" And they even kind of mention it here. You speak of RIPD, you know, Men in Black with ghosts. And I say again, this was Men in Black combined with Dead Like Me. And then you have the animated snail picture called Turbo, in which Reynolds voices the lead gastropod. Universal's $182 million RIPD brought in a paltry $12.8 million. Whereas DreamWorks Animation's $135 million Turbo scored only $28.5 million.
And you consider that these big budget flops were trounced by the much cheaper The Conjuring, which made a tidy $41.5 million and only cost $20 million to make.
It already paid off its debt.
Exactly. Right, it is officially $1.5 million in the green, no matter how you look at it. I mean, if you want to do the doubling of budgets and all that kind of stuff, it is $1.5 million in the green, no matter what. There's always a chance that Reynolds' latest flicks will make up their money back in overseas sales and rentals or not. As for whether we've ever seen this specific flavor of theatrical Ragnarok before, two opening weekend flops, one actor, well, not exactly. The article continues, quote, "Nothing immediately comes to mind," end quote, says Len Clady of Movie City News, though it's worth noting that Taylor Kitsch did have three initial box office disappointments in a single year in 2012. John Carter, Battleship, and Savages. Those first two flicks cost more than $450 million combined, but their collective box office take, at least stateside, has yet to top $140 million. Wow. Terrible, terrible, terrible. The article continues to go on and basically say, why does he continue to get these roles in these big pictures when his last few movies have really not been all that great? Green Lantern... While the Green Lantern has technically made its money, it stumbled across the finish line to do so and really made its money overseas. Nothing here. But then people are like, yeah, but he's a familiar face. And then you kind of say, but what about movies like Buried, where he does a really good job in the movie? So is it just he's picking bad projects, or he's getting good projects and they're getting ruined in post-production? Maybe a combination of the two?
Yeah, it could be a contractual agreement and stuff like that.
I don't know. It's kind of sad, though. But the thing is, for me, is that my understanding that with Turbo, I thought it was with Turbo, Ryan Reynolds came in and redid somebody else's stuff. Is that not right?
I do know that with the movie Planes, Dane Cook came in and completely redid the main plane character's dialogue. And I think it was John Cryer who... Was he...
That's what... Okay, you're right. No, that's what it was. You were talking about that last week. That's what it was. Okay. Which I don't understand. How the hell is Dane Cook bigger than John Cryer?
I don't know.
No. What, in what universe are we redoing an entire movie to bring it to the theaters and John Cryer is lower on the list than Dane Cook? I'm sorry. You know, John Cryer's only been part of 2.5 Men for the last, like, what, 9 years or something like that? Okay. Whatever. I don't know. Maybe they felt bad because of what Dane Cook's brother-in-law did to him. I don't know. Anyway, so Ryan Reynolds, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I don't know what to say. I kind of like some of the smart-assier roles that he's taken over the years. I especially liked him in... was it Blade 2 or Blade 3?
Trinity.
Okay. Yeah. I thought he did fantastic in that. That was the first time I ever really remember seeing him. And then he was also in, when he was in Waiting, I thought that was really good. And then the one where he's like the best friend who lost all the weight.
Just Friends?
Just Friends. So, I don't know. I really think he's got potential.
Yeah, he's come a long way since Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place.
Which is true. So, I guess we'll, you know, jury's just going to be out. Maybe he'll land another hit somewhere along the way. I'm not sure. Last but not least, some sad news. This is I just happened to grab the first headline tag, and so we got. I happened to grab FoxNews.com from their entertainment section. Dennis Farina, a one-time Chicago cop who, as a popular actor, played a cop on Law & Order, has died. Farina died Monday morning in Scottsdale, Arizona, after suffering a blood clot in his lung. For 3 decades, Farina was a character actor who displayed remarkable dexterity, charm, and, when called for, toughness, making effective use of his craggy face, steel gray hair, ivory smile, and ample mustache. He appeared in such films as Get Shorty, Saving Private Ryan, Midnight Run, and Out of Sight. He's a good guy.
Yeah, good people, actor, too.
I really liked him.
Toothbrush, we're going to London. Do you hear that, Doug? I'm coming to London! Evie! Shut up and sit down, you big bald fuck. I don't like leaving my own country, Doug, and I especially don't like leaving it for anything less than warm, sandy beaches and cocktails with little straw hats.
Yeah, everybody always goes with Snatch. He actually did a movie, That Old Beeling, with Bette Midler, and fantastic. It's a great movie. It's a romantic comedy, and it doesn't It's kind of funny because the movie is technically not about them, although it's their relationship that drives the entire movie. They play divorced people who kind of get back together and kind of fall back in love when their kids are trying to get married and stuff. It's kind of funny. That was when I really took notice of him and kind of went back and started watching some of his old stuff. And then, of course, watched Snatch, all that kind of stuff. And it's just kind of sad. But it's not like he was born in, 1944? So, I mean, definitely nearly 70 years old. I gotta say, if you're getting 69, 70, I think it's fair to say he had a pretty good life there.
Yeah, agreed. Unless he suffered.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to be dismissive. It's always sad when someone, especially the good guys, pass away. That, however, is my news, sir.
Alrighty, so we shall move right along into the Butler news. And that's right. The Butler, the Weinstein Company, and the Warner Brothers, the two clashing studios that have been arguing over the name of Lee Daniels' film called The Butler, has finally come to an agreement. And they agreed that the title will not be just The Butler, however, it will be Lee Daniels' The Butler. And really, nobody really actually won anything. It was kind of more so like a MPAA ruling than anything else. It was just basically just so that everything just kind of is set in stone so things can move on, because this movie is going to be coming out into theaters August 13th. And on cinemablend.com, they ask, so what happens if the Weinstein Company doesn't hurry up and change everything? That they don't change the title of the movie on all the promotional material in time. And they say that, pretend you can hear me making a cha-ching sounds a bunch of times. Already, the Weinstein Company has to pay the Entertainment Industry Foundation a whopping $400,000 for initially violating the July 2nd ruling. Since then, each day that the promotional material failed to reflect that ruling is costing the Weinstein Company $25,000. So that's another $475,000 going to the charity. If July 26 gets here and they still haven't changed the title, the daily fine jumps up to $50,000. $50,000. In addition, the Weinstein Company has to pay Warner's legal fees to the tune of $150,000. Over $1 million in the hole, all because the Weinstein Company thought their trumped up legal team, which included one of the Proposition 8 lawyers, could finagle an agreement out of Warner's unyielding team. End quote. So finally, all that has come to an end. I was kind of already told that this was going to be how it ended. I just don't understand why the Weinstein Company just decided to run with The Butler and not go ahead and just do it. Lee Daniels' The Butler a month ago or 2 months ago or whatever. Instead, they just lost another $500,000 just because they're stubborn and, I guess, pretty cocky when it comes to what they want to name what. Now, the Avengers, during Comic-Con this past weekend, they announced some interesting tidbits of information about the upcoming Avengers sequel, and one of those tidbits of information is actually the title of the sequel, and the title of The Avengers 2 is called The Age of Ultron, or just Age of Ultron. A lot of people are wondering if they're grabbing the name from the comic book that recently came out, in which he actually is. However, he is not taking any of the information from that comic book. On an interview via Collider.com, he goes on to say,
yeah, a lot of people, because we called it Age of Ultron, and there was a book, Age of Ultron, just recently assumed that was the storyline we're doing, which is not the case. We're doing our own version of the origin story of Ultron, and the other thing is, in the origin story, there was Hank Pym, so a lot of people assumed he was going to be in the mix, but he's not, because we're basically taking the things from the comics for the movies that we need and can use. A lot of stuff has to fall by the wayside. Ultron was their chief villain when I read the book. He's been the Avengers villain for so long. I was amazed anybody was surprised it was going to be him in the movie, but we sort of were crafting our own version of it, where his origin comes more directly from the Avengers we already know about. It's a little bit darker than the other film. Because Ultron's in the house, there's a science fiction element that I think is a little bit stronger than the other film. And, getting the team together was so rousing. But seriously, keeping the team together is a completely different problem.
And then finally, Whedon has, I guess, a much grandiose plans for Hawkeye. Hawkeye kind of got screwed over in the Avengers. He really didn't have that great of a character, according to fans, as well as according to the actor who played him.
Part of the fun for me, definitely, this time around, is writing Hawkeye. Because, you know, he did get possessed pretty early by a bad guy and sort of have to walk around scowly for most of the movie last time. And so now it's nice to actually have the character there and really see him interact with the other guys.
So there you go. You got the name of the next Avengers movie. You have exactly what the film is not going to be about and who the film is not going to include. And it's kind of a shame, really, because the Age of Ultron story had the robot take on a mind of its own and terrorize and completely take over the entire world, causing the Avengers to live underneath Central Park. I don't know if that's underground or if they have a bunker or they're actually living in Central Park. I really don't know what the whole situation is. But that would have been very interesting. That would definitely have been a more darker tone to the whole franchise and that film in particular. But who knows? Joss Whedon and all these guys, all these Marvel guys, are known for lying to their fan base. Good lies, not horrible ones, just to piss people off, but just to keep people looking forward to the movie. And finally, is news about the anticipated sequel to Man of Steel. And this news is coming from Comic-Con, where Zack Snyder pretty much spilled the beans, saying that, well, actually, he didn't say, they showed a video of the Superman logo with the Batman logo appearing within it or around it, encapsulating it, or something like that, hinting at there will be a Batman-Superman movie that will actually be the sequel to Man of Steel. So it won't be Man of Steel, and David S. Goyer, who wrote and produced the Man of Steel movie that just came out, will be back to write the movie, along with Zack Snyder, and Zack Snyder will again direct. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but you know what, I'll give him another shot, because maybe, with me at least, he'll strike gold with this one. Because it has Batman in it, and I think it'll be a lot of fun. And also, Christopher Nolan is said to be producing this movie again, so I don't know if they're going to be bringing back the same characteristics that his Batman, the Christian Bale Batman, has brought to their Batman movies, or if this is going to be a new Batman altogether. And Snyder said that, quote, "It's official that we are going to make another Superman movie. The truth is, you don't want me to tell you what the movie's about, but I can say that maybe there's a single element that will be in the film that I could help you out with," end quote. And that is obviously the Batman. And they're actually taking elements from the comic book, actually the Frank Miller comic book called The Dark Knight Returns. And actually just recently, they released a cartoon movie version of The Dark Knight Returns graphic novel or comic book. Very dark. It has Superman in it. And this is kind of what they're going to be modeling it after. They're going to be foes. They're not going to be working together. They're going to be against each other. Therefore, according to David S. Goyer, the producer, he is saying that the movie will either be called Batman vs. Superman or Superman vs. Batman. They can't really decide which one to call it, whether if one would be more better than the other or if that's kind of taking sides, or I don't know. Who knows? I mean, we'll let other people decide that. So what do you think of that title, Matt? Do you think that's a wise decision by those guys, having the sequel to Man of Steel to be a Batman-Superman movie where they are actually against each other and not necessarily working side by side, fighting crime?
I think it can work. It is going to have to be done. This isn't one of those, well, if they do it right, it'll work kind of things. They are going to have to do it exactly right. They can't mess up one iota of this story. They're going to have to, I think with what they've done for Man of Steel, done a good job of setting up how Superman is going to behave and what his parameters are for being the good guy. Batman is the only unknown, because we don't know if they are continuing along the Joseph Gordon-Levitt saga. And I'm not saying that they're going to use Joseph Gordon-Levitt. They could just recast and keep the same character. So we don't know if they're going to have that angle going for Batman. And then, given that character, are they going to make Batman, are they going to make him be kind of the wild card? Or are they going to create a scenario where one of them can be indifferent to the problem because it's an outside looking in, whereas the other one, and it could go either way. I mean, this could be something where they kill off Clark's mom, right? Or it could be something where they hurt Batman somehow, so that Batman has to take it more seriously than Superman would, and vice versa. It's everything is going to have to be exactly right. They've got to get the characters in place, and they're going to have the stories, and then they're going to have to pull it off in a believable way. Because we know that by the end of it, it's going to be like The Heat for superheroes. They're going to be against each other and have to work together and not want to, but then by the end of it, they'll have that grudging admiration for one another and sit down in their cafe and have shawarma at the end. So long story short, I got no fucking idea. I hope it works. I'm not sure that it will.
Yeah, we'll just see. I just wonder, if they're going to have to, develop a new tone to the movie, because now you're introducing two characters. Kind of like with, the Avengers. The tone of the Avengers and the feel of the Avengers, it is its own entity. You know, it's its own thing. Because you can't really take all those characters and put them in the Iron Man universe, the Iron Man atmosphere. So I wonder if they're going to create a new one, or if they're just going to keep on going with the shaky cam, grainy, moot-colored Man of Steel. I'm excited to see what they're going to do. Definitely a different turn for a Batman movie, especially.
Indeed. Yes. All right, well then I guess it is time, correct? Is it time?
Yeah, I believe so.
Then let's do it, folks. It's time for Three Slayers! Yes, Three Squared. All right, folks. This time we had our favorite movies with a color in the title. I'm excited for this one. I think this could be a lot of fun.
I agree.
So, yeah, I am very excited about these movies and about this one here. Would you like to go first on this one, Tim, or do you want me to go first?
Why don't you go first?
Okay. These are actually ranked for me for, third, second, first. And I'm going to start off with a technicality, because everybody refers to this movie one way, but it does technically have a color in the title. It's Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. You see how I did that? You got to do the stuff after the colon. That was funny, right? This, of course, is the Will Ferrell, Christina Applegate, Paul Rudd, Steve Carell, Dave Kochner, and Fred Willard comedy that basically set up the one phrase that everyone always knows. Stay classy, San Diego. Or go fuck yourself. Whichever you prefer is to be the funniest.
Diversity means the times are changing. And with that in mind, Ron, are you paying attention?
Nope.
Well, this concerns all of us.
Okay.
Keeping that in mind, I'd like to introduce the latest addition to the KVWN news team, directly from WYPN in Asheville, North Carolina, Ms. Veronica Corningstone.
Hello, everyone. I just want you all to know that I look forward to contributing to this news station's already sterling reputation.
I mean, come on, Ed, it's bullcrap. Don't get me wrong, I love the ladies. I mean, they rev my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom. It is Anchor Man, not Anchor Lady, and that is a scientific fact.
Huh?
I don't know what we're yelling about. You're with us, Ron. What do you think? It's terrible. She has beautiful eyes, and her hair smells like cinnamon.
Mm-hmm.
Loud noises!
All right, everyone relax. She's not going to take anyone's airtime.
I read somewhere that their periods attract bears. The bears can smell the menstruation.
Well, that's just great. You hear that, Ed? Bears. Now you're putting the whole station in jeopardy.
The 2004 comedy here is probably one of, I would have to put it in definitely my top five comedies of all time. And that's saying something, because it's really hard to break into the top five comedies, because you are competing with such classics as Airplane and The Naked Gun. So it's really hard to get to, because you're never going to top those two. This is definitely, however, Will Ferrell at his best. And I really and truly can't say enough good things about it. This was a movie, a comedy. So a $26 million budget and brought in over $90 million. And It was also so good that the outtakes from the movie, all of the deleted scenes and extra cuts, were able to be edited into an entirely separate movie. That's not even related. It's just, it was its own movie. It was just fantastic that they were able to do that. And now we're getting Anchorman 2. Next up on my list, number two. This is, I don't know. Number one on my list here is really more sentimental. So I'm not sure if it's technically the better movie, but it didn't matter. Sentimentality won out for me here. So number two on my list, Silver Linings Playbook. Yes, this was the one that I literally had to be arm twisted into seeing because I couldn't understand why this thing was up for Best Picture and how the hell are these, you know, Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, really, they acted that well? And of course, they did. This movie was fantastic. Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence, Robert De Niro, Jackie Weaver, I mean, Chris Tucker even in this movie was fantastic for his small role. And of course, these are the two dysfunctional people who have had some mental health issues who basically are living with their parents even though they are way too old to be living with their parents, both trying to put their lives back together after some terrible relationship issues that culminated in further mental problems. And then, of course, their story of falling in love. I think that this is one of the best movies that I had seen in a long time. Definitely blew me away. I had my wife sit down when we went and watched this. I was surprised that she was willing to do it, but she's kind of got a thing for Bradley Cooper, so it wasn't that difficult. And she loved it too. So, fantastic movie. And now we break into the number one pick for me, The Green Mile. That's right. Based on the Stephen King novels, and this was kind of cool because the novels were serialized, which I thought was really kind of cool. They released them in certain fashion, much like they did back in the olden days. And if I remember correctly, The Green Mile was also Stephen King's first novel, essentially, after his accident. So this was more fantastic. And then, of course, they turned it into a movie. Frank Darabont, who we have spoken about before, was the director and also did the screenplay. This one, of course, stars Tom Hanks, David Morse, Bonnie Hunt, and, James Cromwell, Sam Rockwell, Barry Pepper. I mean, there's tons of good people. And, of course, this is the movie that launched Michael Clark Duncan into superstardom and where he also got his Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor. This, of course, is the story of a man played by Tom Hanks who was a guard on death row back in the 30s. And they come across a gentleman, and he really is a gentleman, named John Coffey, who has been convicted of raping and killing two young white girls. And this, of course, is why he's on death row. He, of course, is innocent of these crimes. And not only is he innocent and just willing to go along with life as it's taken him on this terrible path, he also has the ability to heal people. And so you get to see his interactions with these people, how he changes so many lives, and yet how he decides more or less to live out the end of his own. This is, I can't say, because it was also nominated for Best Picture, I can't say which one of these is technically the better movie, Green Mile or Silver Linings Playbook, but this one really got to me in a way that, while I can completely acknowledge Silver Linings Playbook as a great film, The Green Mile just really touched me. It hit me in the feels a lot more than Silver Linings Playbook did. And so that, for me, is why it is number one. Again, my picks here. Number three, Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. Number two, Silver Linings Playbook. And number one, Green Mile.
Hopefully you didn't enjoy this 3-squared too much.
No, it was terrible. Oh, it's just grating on me.
Well, good, good. Now, my 3-squared, these are movies that I guess I never really thought about how much these movies really pop out. Like, whenever I think of a particular color, I really don't associate it to food or to smells that I think a lot of other people associate colors with. With me, I associate colors to films. Like, I look at something blue and I think Deep Blue Sea, and or green, and associate with The Green Mile, however Matt took that one. So my movies are very significant to me on a very personal level, because it seems like I associate these movies the most with the particular colors that are represented within their titles, if that makes any sense whatsoever. But with saying that, my first movie is from 1985, and it's the Woody Allen film, The Purple Rose of Cairo, with Jeff Daniels and Mia Farrow. If any of you guys haven't seen this movie, I beg you to please go. Don't stop the show. No, don't stop the show. Continue listening onto the show. But watch it after the show. Or actually, just put the show on pause and then look it up and rent it. Go on your Netflix and rent it. Or, no, I guess you can pause the show and go get it from Red. Or I guess you can't get it from Red. And there's no Blockbuster around, so, you know what? Buy it. Buy the movie. Pause the episode and go. Just go buy it. Now that you're back, because I'm sure a number of you haven't seen the movie, the film, it takes place during the Depression, so during the 1920s, 1930s, and the movie is about this young woman who falls in love with a movie character who just simply walks off the screen and into her life. And the woman is Mia Farrow, and the Hollywood actor, the Hollywood character that she falls in love with is played by the wonderful Jeff Daniels.
I never had champagne before. It makes me feel silly.
It's supposed to. The check is you requested, sir.
That's so much.
I hope you found it to your liking, sir.
Oh,
it was superb.
It was wonderful.
My compliments to the chef. And keep 20% for yourself. No, make that 30%. Yes, quite amusing. What is it? The fake money. Fake money? Is it play money, sir, or stage money? Keep 30% for yourself and stop looking so serious. I'll get the maitre d'.
Tom, that's not real money.
What do you mean it's not real money? Oh, my God. Do you have any money?
No. What are we going to do?
We're going to have to make a run for it.
No, I can't run. My ankles are bad from waitressing.
Get up. Follow me.
This movie is sweet. It's inventive. It's one of the smartest movies ever made. If you guys have seen Woody Allen's one of his most recent movies called Midnight in Paris with Owen Wilson, it's kind of in that same vein where it's more of like a magical, dreamlike kind of movie. It really kind of tugs at your heart a bit to where these people are living out their dreams and they're getting exactly what they want out of life, and it completely works for them, and so you just feel that through this entire movie, and you appreciate it, and by God, you will appreciate this movie doing that for you. So again, The Purple Rose of Cairo, gotta check it out. The next movie is from 1964, and it's Blake Edwards' The Pink Panther, with David Niven and Peter Sellers. And for those of you who do not know this about the Pink Panther movie, this movie was originally intended to be a vehicle for David Niven himself. In fact, David Niven's character, who actually is the jewel thief, it turns out he is the phantom, le fantôme, that the Inspector Clouseau is trying to find and get the Pink Panther diamond from him. Peter Sellers, Clouseau, is actually supposed to be the bumbling, goofy comic relief throughout the entire movie. Because as you can tell, I mean, this is definitely noticeable whenever the big stars, including David Niven, is on screen all at the same time. Because Peter Sellers isn't the one that's directly in the center of the frame. He's kind of off the frame or off to the side. And it's always on David Niven or the lady who he's trying to woo throughout the movie. So, again, The Pink Panther, if you haven't seen it, you have to. It's a comedic staple in all of comedy movies. One of my top five favorite movies. It is, I think, the anchorman of the 1960s. At least the early 1960s. And then finally, my final and last 3-squared is from 1947. And it is Black Narcissus. Now, Black Narcissus is actually a movie that Matt and I covered, maybe 2 years ago. This is a movie with Deborah Kerr. Sabu, if you know him from Mowgli, from one of the original live-action Jungle Book movies. Gene Simmons, David Farrar, Flora Robson. This is directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. And this movie is also known by its beautiful cinematography that was done by Jack Cardiff. Absolutely beautiful. This movie is one of the most ingenious psychological dramas ever made, at least that I've ever seen. It's actually the most ingenious psychological drama with nuns that I've ever seen. I forgot to mention the with nuns part for an extra flair to the movie. The movie's about all these women. They're in a convent and they're nuns and they're just isolated. They're up in the Himalayas. The only really human interaction they have is with the tribal people that kind of live further down the mountain. Some of these nurses can't take it, especially one nurse in particular, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, who starts seeing things and starts getting suspicious about the other nuns, and slowly but surely becomes a little bit crazy and starts going off the deep end by the end of the movie. It is beautifully shot, like I said, by Jack Cardiff. The nuns are shown with their elegant white robes amid the film's exotic settings, where the tribal people are more colorful and they have their earthy tones, and some of them have the bright reds and the blues and the golds and the silvers, and it completely contradicts the white, the stark white, bland nunnery setting that they have up at the top of this mountain. So, you know, that's just kind of a taste of the movie. There's a lot more to it. There's a lot more to all these movies, but I implore you guys to definitely see it. So again, my three movies are Woody Allen's The Purple Rose of Cairo, Blake Edwards' Pink Panther, and then finally, Michael Powell's and Emmerich Pressenberger's Black Narcissus from 1947.
Outstanding! Nice pick, sir. Although, while I definitely agree that Pink Panther is an outstanding movie and very funny, and of course launched Peter Sellers and all that good stuff, I don't feel that it was the Anchorman of the early 60s. I do agree that it is a great movie and also a very funny movie, though.
Right. And well, and actually Shot in the Dark, the sequel, is, I think, more superior than the first one. Maybe that could be the Anchorman of the 60s, the sequel.
Sure. We might have to just spend a show kind of just arguing which, when we take our movies and, you know, we're like, oh, well, I think Anchorman's better for this, or, and you're like, oh, Shot in the Dark, or what. Maybe we could just, you know, have kind of a cage match episode where we just pair up movies that we know we're going to fight over and then just actually try to hash it out.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
I'm down.
We'll plan one of those out. Okay, so next week's Three Squared is going to be in honor of the passing of Dennis Farina. We're going to do our favorite Dennis Farina films, which you think of him as a character actor, but he's been in a lot of really good stuff. So, yay. Very exciting. And now, the news is done. The Three Squared is complete. And here we are at the movies. Yes, the movies. All right, the movies this week were Silenced, also known as The Crucible, which is the Korean film about some horrible things that happened to some kids that they didn't deserve.
That's putting it lightly.
The film The Last Mogul, which was a documentary on Lou Wasserman, head of MCA, Universal. And then finally, Blue Valentine. And I am down, sir. What do you want to start with?
Well, we have two depressing movies and one not-so-depressing movie. So should we do the not-so-depressing movie in between the two depressing movies, or should we knock out the not-so-depressing movie to prepare us for a double team of the back-to-back of Blue Valentine and Silenced?
Let's do the peaks and valleys thing. Let's start with one of the sad ones. Slip the Lou Wasserman in the middle, and then end on another sad one.
Here's the next question, is that we can't necessarily say, well, which one is the most depressing of the two movies, because one of them you're dealing with the loss of love and a spouse, and the other one you're dealing with child abuse.
Yeah, the loss of innocence. This one and that one was based on a true story.
Right. Let's do the loss of innocence first. Let's do that one.
Okay. All right, let's do that. Okay, so this is a movie on Netflix. It's called Silenced. If you're looking at it on Netflix, it's also known as The Crucible. And this is a Korean film. It is based on The Crucible by Gong Ji-young. It stars Gong Yoo and Jung Yoo-mi.
Excuse me?
Oh, you're so funny. Okay, film is very, very graphic. It is based on actual events that took place at Gwangju Inhwa School for the Hearing Impaired, where young deaf students, like kids, like 9, 5, young deaf students, they were the victims of repeated sexual assaults by faculty members over a period of 5 years in the early 2000s. And the film did a fantastic job of showing just how bad the system, in some ways, I guess still is, but definitely was, even as much as 10 years ago, where you have these faculty members of a school who pick children who are either extremely poor, who have mental issues, mental health issues, and not even so much mental health issues, but definitely where they are inhibited. They're learning disabled would be easy, in addition to being deaf. And or they're choosing orphans. And then they masquerade as high-profile Christians in their community. And of course, because of the way that they use their inside connections in the school systems and also the state, they are able to get extra money for themselves. They're able to pay off cops. They are even able to utilize the judicial system to automatically win in their favor no matter what. Because there was a practice done in again, this might be one of the things that have changed, it might not have, where if you get a former judge to be your lawyer, they automatically rule in favor of the judge for as much as they possibly can. And this is as a thank you for your service to the judicial system for all of those years, we're going to help you win your first case. Even if you're representing someone who has raped and molested children, in which case, well, okay, we can't let them off, but we can make sure that their sentences are very light. This movie, because of the events that it was based on, was so influential and caused such outrage. Because again, based on true events, and the events, this is one of those ones where you just can't get away. You could make this movie as terrible as you want. And the simple fact is that because it's based on school faculty who rape and molest small deaf children, you can make up anything else you want outside of that because that's bad enough. The outcry was so great that some of the people that the characters were based on were actually retried and they got tougher sentences. Unfortunately, because so much time had passed, even after this film, some of the other people were never even charged.
And they're still working at that school.
Yes. Well, the school got closed. After the when all of this stuff came out and the and it came out that these people were still in school, the public outcry was so bad that they finally closed the school down.
Yeah, like last year, right? Wasn't it 2012?
2011.
Okay.
And it's sad because that was probably, who knows how many years too late. I think that this movie is a great movie. This is an excellent piece and an excellent example of why Americans, specifically Americans, I mean, I hate to do this, but it's a simple fact. People need to get out there and watch a foreign film every once in a while. You have no idea what kind of amazing shit you're missing out on. And this is just a drama. Let's forget about the kick-ass movies that Tim and I have already talked about before. This is just another amazing reason why you've got to get out there, expand your horizons a little bit. And thankfully, Netflix has that available for you. Subtitles and everything. It's excellently shot. The music is used to really good effect. It plays out like a horror movie. It has excellent thriller elements into it. As well, and I mean, God, I was angry at the end of the movie, and yet even still, it was just powerful and awesome, and it made me go and look it up a little bit more, and that, and I was glad at least a couple of people got brought to justice. You've just got to see this movie. This is a 5-star movie, hands down. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, it's definitely a really good movie, especially a historical movie where you can tell that the people who made this movie really do care about the information that it's based on, about the kids that were affected by this cruel, inhumane things that happened to them. Now, from a historical point of view and how they went about creating the movie based on that is something that is actually true to life, they did a phenomenal job. Started the movie off right off the bat with basically what you're going to be expecting for the entire movie. Child kills himself, throws himself in front of a train, or lets himself get hit by a train just because he just got raped by a grown man, a really crazy grown man. And then it goes into the guy, the hero, I guess, or the guy who's trying to be the hero, ends up becoming a teacher and goes into the school. And he starts seeing all the stuff going on, and he doesn't know whether to stand up and do the right thing, which is to bring the attention of all this stuff to the police, which they do end up trying to get a hold of the police, but the police, you know, they're corrupted by the people that are kind of running this whole thing, by the people who run the school, because the principal is such of high stature within the community. He's the head of the church. He does this, he gives money to these people, he pays people off, just keep things silenced. just so he can feed his weird sexual want, and that would be kids, young kids, boys and girls. And it is just weird. And this movie captures all that stuff beautifully. It shows no mercy for the bad guys at all. It is pro-good completely, which I agree. I'm glad it doesn't try to show any humanistic side to who is pretty much the villain, who actually is the villain. The flashbacks, the ratio of the flashbacks and the court proceedings, as well as the guy's relationship with the kids really well. I mean, you have all that stuff to deal with in this movie. You have the whole court side of it. You have the flashbacks of these kids kind of telling their story of being molested. And then you have this guy in his personal life, him having to raise his daughter and him having to deal with his mother. So you have all those elements that the movie just handles perfectly. Now, on a movie standpoint, I think this is a 4 to 4.5 star movie. There were some pacing issues at the end where it just kind of seemed like they elongated certain scenes to where they just drug out just for a emotional plea from the audience, just try to get them to feel something that should have already have been there from, I guess, the first 5 minutes of the movie, when just right off the bat, especially from all these graphic rape scenes that you see involving the adults and these kids that, you know, you were completely torn apart inside. But by the end of the movie, they still try to get as much as they can, try to milk you for that emotion. And by that time, that stuff kind of already runs a little dry for me. It just seems like they're just trying a little bit too hard when, if they ended the movie 10 minutes earlier, that, man, solid movie right there. It just makes you want to get up and do some research and learn more about the subject. This is definitely a movie that will open your eyes to some of the horrors that happen in this world. Because this world isn't this pretty little box that a lot of people make up in their mind. I mean, you have all these horrors that happen over in the Middle East, in Syria, for example. And yet, when people think about all that, they forget about Japan, they forget about South America, they forget about Mexico, they forget about the stuff that happens in Brazil, they forget about all these other places. So I think it's important to have these movies just so the people can open up their eyes to some of the other worldly problems that are going on. I agree with you, this is definitely an important movie, and this is a movie that everybody should see. And it's definitely not for the faint of heart, so I don't know if showing this to your grandmother, to your elderly grandmother, would be a good idea.
Yeah, this is definitely not a movie for the faint. Like, not even kidding around or anything. This is not, yeah. You need to be able to handle graphic shit. Well then, okay, let's go to our only non-depressing film, which, it's a documentary, it's called The Last Mogul, and basically this is the life and times of Louis Robert Wasserman, who was better known as Lou. And this is a guy who essentially became the face of Hollywood in terms of the management end. He was truly the last mogul. He took MCA. He comes out of Cleveland, heads over to LA, to Hollywood, brings out MCA, which stands for Music Corporation of America, and then says, we're turning ourselves into a talent agency, and then essentially just takes over. In that taking over, he starts revolutionizing the way that Hollywood works, decides to eventually take over buyout Universal and merges it together and creates MCA Universal. He then dominates television and becomes uber rich, but more importantly, uber powerful. That's pretty much it. I mean, the man just is the end-all be-all.
And he drastically changed the motion picture industry of how you run a movie studio.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And yet, he also became a little too intoxicated with his own power and lost it to a certain degree. Regained, fought back, regained, because when he realized just exactly what Congress could do to him, which is what Bobby Kennedy did, he then says, oh, well, we can't have that again. So he then starts working into politics. And while he became very influential in the Democratic Party, there was one Republican that he managed to get in really good with, which was Ronald Reagan. I mean to tell you, this guy, he had way more success than he had failures. But the stumbles that he had were gigantic, especially towards the end of his career, were simply non-recoverable. And it eventually did cost him his company. And it really was, he looked at it as his company. It's a very interesting movie. It's rated PG-13 as a documentary because of two uses of the word fuck from one guy in one sentence. It really doesn't need a PG-13 rating. It's honestly a little bit too long. I think that they could have cut out probably 20 minutes of that. But I mean, it was interesting. It was really interesting to see the story of Hollywood from the back end and through the largest, most important guiding hand of that. It is interesting. I think that if you are a fan of Hollywood and you are into the historical side of Hollywood, this would definitely be something that you should check out. Otherwise, I would say skip it. And of those who are going to see it, I think you're probably going to find this a charitable 3-star range, but still interesting.
Yeah, I think I gave it more of a 4-star. I don't know. I think I got a lot more out of it because I kind of that I live in his domain, so I thought it was really cool, like hearing some of the slang of Hollywood and seeing actually able to go outside and see all the different things he built. Universal City, the whole Universal Studios complex that he built, the whole lot, which is a studio city of its own, is just right down the road from here. So it's really cool being able to see it. And just to add on a little bit to what Matt was saying earlier about the merging of MCA with Universal Studios and how much of a power play that was into the realm of entertainment business. Following World War II, televisions were becoming a hot commodity. People weren't going out to the movie theaters as much anymore. Therefore, the movie industry was starting to lose money. I mean, if you thought that the movie industry was having financial woes now for the future, or that they were worried about major slump in ticket prices now, back in the 60s, it was even worse. Probably more like maybe half of the profits that they were originally making were not there during the 60s because of television. Because people just thought, well, I can just watch the same stuff on TV that I don't have to go and watch the serials at the movie theater. Cartoons are showing here. I can watch Bugs Bunny and Goofy on TV. I don't have to go watch Bugs Bunny and Goofy at the movie theater. So following all of that post-war television popularity, and that was actually the result of all these movie studios going underwater in terms of money and in bankruptcy especially. So Wasserman went in and purchased Universal Studios as well as Decca Records. So at that time, not only was he managing movie stars, but as well as musicians, everybody. I mean, he had a hand in every single pot that dealt with entertainment, minus more probably the technical stuff. So in 1962, he merged Universal and Decca Records with MCA. And then in 1966, he went ahead and made his little friend at the time, Jack J. Valenti. He is actually the name of my communication school that I graduated from at U of H. Lou Wasserman helped make Jack J. Valenti the head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. And it was them together that they orchestrated much of Hollywood at that time. They controlled the studio, what the look of the studio. I mean, how we look at a studio now, that is because of Lou Wasserman. How we look at Hollywood politics, studio politics, actor-musician relationship with their manager politics or whatever, it's because of Lou Wasserman and this groundwork that he laid out for the future, for the people that are now and forever will run Hollywood. It is because of him. I just think he's a phenomenal guy, and I would just hate to think about what Hollywood would have turned out to be like without him as a studio head to kind of be the pioneer of the business.
I see that you definitely did get more out of it than I did. I mean, I didn't. That's all those things that you spoke of did not go over my head. I think that perhaps this just was a film that, it's kind of awkward saying this because it came out, it was made in 2005, but I don't know. It could just use an update, I guess, even though it's been less than 10 years. I think that there could have been a better way to do this. It was just shot and presented much like an A&E biography show, and those ones only run 45 minutes.
Right.
So that's where my problem comes in. It's not the subject matter. Again, that's why I say you should check this out, especially if you're into the history of Hollywood, if you like history like me, or if you are into movies and want to know more about the backside like me, and definitely like you, this is a movie that you should check out. I would still say that, though, just the general public would probably pass on this. So. Awesome. All right, well, then let's go into Blue Valentine. And this, of course, is the Derek Clanfrance movie that stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. And this is a movie about a couple who are shifting back and forth between the beginning and what is presumably the end of their relationship.
You're not gonna eat that?
Why don't you do something?
What do you mean?
I don't know.
What does that mean? Why didn't
I
do
know.
Something?
I mean, isn't there something you wanted to do? Isn't there something you want to do?
Like when?
I don't know. If you're so good at so many things, you could do anything you wanted to do. You're good at everything that you do. Isn't there something else you want to do?
Then what? Then be your husband? Then be Frankie's dad? What do you want me to do? What in your, like, dream scenario of me, like, doing what I'm good at, what would that be?
I don't know. I just mean you're so good at so many things. You can do so many things. You have such capacity.
For what?
I don't. You can sing. You can draw. You can dance.
Listen, I didn't want to be somebody's husband. Okay? And I didn't want to be somebody's dad. That wasn't my goal in life. Some guys it is. It wasn't mine. But somehow, it was what I wanted. I didn't know that. And that's all I want to do. I don't want to do anything else. That's what I want to do. I work so I can do that.
I'd like to see you have a job where you don't have to start drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning to go to it.
No, I have a job that I can drink at 8 o'clock in the morning. What a luxury, you know? I get up from work, I have a beer, I go to work, I paint somebody's house, they're excited about it, I come home, I get to be with you. What's, like, this is the dream.
It doesn't ever disappoint you?
Why? Why would it disappoint me?
Because
I could still do whatever I could do. So what? Why do you have to fucking make money off your potential?
Look, I'm not even saying you have to make money off 15 minutes.
What does even potential mean? What does that mean, potential? Potential for what? To turn it into what?
We rarely sit down and have an adult conversation because every time we do, you take what I say and you turn it around into something that I didn't mean. You just twist it. Start blabbing. Blah, 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 blah.
If you're not interested in what I have to say, then maybe I just shouldn't say anything.
This movie, as you have just been hearing and as we've just said, is definitely a great movie. For me, this is a 5-star movie. I think that it is shot wonderfully. I think the music is perfect because it's subtle and yet makes itself striking. The story is good. I think that the edging, the way that the flashbacks work, it's almost like it's not a flashback. It's kind of like the juxtaposition. You're watching the, or not even a juxtaposition really, it's literally a compare and contrast. You're watching the approximation of the beginning of a relationship against the beginning of the end versus the build up to the true beginning, to the build up of the true end, to the climax of falling in love and what it all means, to the climax of the end of a relationship, to the beginning of the start of a life together, to the beginning of a life apart. This movie was exceptionally difficult for me to watch it because it was like watching my first marriage all over again. And on a personal level, after what Dean, which is Ryan Gosling's character, did for Cindy, which is of course Michelle Williams' character, how she could not give him that one chance that they both desperately needed. That's what hurt the most, because there is a child involved, and this child is no more than 5. By the time you get to the end of the movie, they pretty much put the writing on the wall. They pretty much said, you know, you definitely get the feeling that that's it, but they don't explicitly say it. And if you choose to, like I choose to, there's still a glimmer of hope. It's the tiniest of glimmers, but it's still a glimmer. And that's only if you choose to see it that way. That's all I'm really comfortable saying, because it was very, very difficult for me to watch this movie. It got to me on such a personal level. So that's all. That is all I can say. It's 5 stars for me, and you should see it.
This movie did a lot of things right. In fact, it did everything right. It has the humor aspect. Matt, were you able to laugh at the movie at times?
Not really.
Not really?
Not that it wasn't... Don't get me wrong. It's not that it wasn't funny.
You just kind of
I understand the parts that you're referring to. I get it. No, don't get me... But, I mean, it was literally like watching my life.
Right.
For me, which was, nobody wants to relive the bad things that have happened to them. So,
right.
So that's why I say that. But no, I understand. I mean, I get what you're saying. I know what scenes you're talking about.
Right. And it's usually Ryan Reynolds, because he's, especially when it's showing their relationship.
Reynolds showed up for this movie? Where?
Not Ryan Reynolds. Shit.
Gosling.
Ryan Gosling. And especially when Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams, when it's their relationship at its beginning, at its birth, when they're two turtle doves in love. They're just really cute and really sweet. And then as it kind of intercuts with where they are currently in the movie, a little bit older, not happy, which I get it as if Michelle Williams' character, she's very unhappy. However, Ryan Gosling seems happy, and that he's accepted his way of life, what he is doing with his life at that moment in time. You can tell he's a wonderful father. He can be a loving husband. He can be a very angry husband, but not until he is pushed to that limit. And you see him get pushed to that limit closer to the end of the movie, where he just really explodes and where you can really just see him get angry. And the reason why Michelle Williams's character is slowly falling out of love with him. Which all that makes the movie much more hard to watch. Because you see the potential that they have together. You see the potential of them having a loving and caring relationship with one another for the rest of their lives. Especially their relationship with their daughter, their home they have together, the things they like to do, their memories of each other, their song together. And you can tell that Ryan Gosling, he is trying his best to make things work. However, with him trying to make things work, alcohol trumps his judgment. Wanting to have sex trumps his judgment. He puts those ahead of the emotional inquiries that his wife needs, or his wife has, or his wife wants. But instead, he'd rather the two of them just party it out and do whatever. What I get from it is that she sees from him that he doesn't want a relationship that is a committed relationship, which they both are committed to the relationship, but he looks that in order to have fun, you do need booze, you need to have a strong sex life, you need all this. However, unless he was just doing that to loosen her up, as in just to have a good time so they can have a fun time together. But this movie is an emotional roller coaster. It is shot wonderfully, brutal to watch. I've gone through my own woes where many of these conversations rung true for me. Many of these fights ring true for me. But yet, the movie does still have hope at the end, if, again, you choose to acknowledge that as hope. If not hope, then the end, then complete sadness. The performances are excellent. The little girl in this movie is ungodly cute. Unbearably cute, actually. I cannot think of a more cuter child actress than her. The relationships are all there. Again, the comedy is there. The build-up is all there, and the emotional climax is definitely there. You cannot miss it. And I gotta say that this director is definitely one of my all-time favorite directors, Derek Cienfrance. He also directed this other movie that I saw with Ryan Gosling and Bradley Cooper called The Place Beyond the Pines. And that, too, is another emotionally engaging movie, definitely a character movie, and it's just fantastic. He's an up-and-coming great director, and I implore everybody to check out this movie as well as The Place Beyond the Pines. But, my God, yeah, Blue Valentine is fantastic. And I also have to note, just as a movie trivia portion of this little review, Blue Valentine was originally rated NC-17 by the MPAA back in October of 2010. This movie was rated NC-17 because of a scene depicting
it's basically cunnilingus.
Exactly. It's oral, womanly oral sex. And this is kind of like a common thing, especially throughout the 70s and 80s, or actually in the 90s movies. There's another movie called This Film Is Not Yet Rated, the documentary about
about getting the NC-17. Really, it was more about the MPAA and whatever, but yeah, sure.
Exactly, and the reason why they do it's okay for a guy to have oral sex. And this is what Ryan Gosling argued. He said, quote, "There's plenty of oral sex in a lot of movies where it's a man receiving it from a woman, and they're rated R. Ours is reversed, and somehow it's perceived as pornographic," end quote. Because of that, the Weinstein Company went and appealed the decision, and at that time, they didn't trim any part of the movie whatsoever. They kept those same scenes in. Then the MPA went ahead and granted the R rating on December 8th of 2010. So everything you see in this movie on Netflix, or you rent the movie, buy the movie or whatever, you are seeing the full movie. There's nothing cut out or anything like that. So that's just a very interesting MPAA story of the rating system. Yeah, so Blue Valentine, I can't really think of anything else to add to it. Other than that, it's a really solid movie.
Cool. All right, well then, let's talk movies for next week. The movies for next week are going to be The Wolverine, Slapshot, and Butter. And of course, Wolverine's the new Hugh Jackman flick. Slapshot is the Randy Newman hockey league flick from 1977. And then Butter is, I want to say it was 2011, I think. And it's an indie comedy starring Jennifer Garner and, oh gosh darn it, who plays her husband?
I think Hugh Jackman in it.
Well, Hugh Jackman is in it, but he doesn't play her husband. I can't remember who played. Oh, it's the guy from Modern Family. I can't think of his name. He plays the husband in, not Ed O'Neill, but, and not the gay guy. So, yeah, at any rate, it's... and that's an indie comedy flick, so we're going to be checking that out. As a bonus, we've decided that we're going to, that we would like to check out The Conjuring. So if you've seen that, we're going to be talking about it if we both go see it. We're kind of having that up in the air. That's kind of like, if we get a chance, we're going to see it, but we're not making it a point to go out of our way to go watch it. And I believe that's it. Yes, is it time to move on, sir, to the spiel?
Yes, sir, spiel on.
Alrighty then, the music that you've been listening to, as always, is brought to you by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also go to reverbnation.com, facebook.com, and myspace.com/criesofsolace. As far as we are concerned, well, we're still the SLS Cast, and you can check us out on our website, slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast. Go to Facebook and search us there. And as always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Steve Martin, I get to say this. What is a movie star? A movie star is many things. They can be tall, short, thin, or skinny. They can be Democrats or skinny.
Quoting the great Frank Herbert, there is no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the story. End quote. This is Tim saying cheers.
See you next week, folks. Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.